This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Do we live our lives or perform them? In a postmodern world, less and less is real. More and more of our experiences are filtered, explained, virtual, and we would not be appropriately self-conscious if we did not begin with me. If you're a regular listener to this program, you've probably come to be fairly familiar with this Neil Conan guy. I make self-deprecating jokes. I like baseball. I like to wish people good luck. To some considerable extent, that is me, but it is also a self-conscious persona, the character who performs on this show. Now, a talk show host is an extreme example, but to some considerable extent, everyone does something similar. We all star as ourselves in the show of life, which is, if you think about it, profoundly different from the way that our grandparents thought about themselves and their lives. Thomas D. Zengotita thought about this for 30 years and wrote a book called Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. And if you'd like to play your self-conscious role on this program, give us a call. In a world where you can no longer tell what's posed and what's candid, what's real or what's virtual, is that a good thing or a bad one? What's the effect of unlimited sensation and unlimited options? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, post-election protests bring down a third post-Soviet government, this time in the Central Asian country of Kyrgyzstan. But first, Mediated. Thomas D. Zengotita joins us from our bureau in New York, and nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Professor, this book is packed with illustrative anecdotes, and let's start with one of your very first, the public mourning of the death of Princess Diana, an event that was thoroughly covered at this time on this network.
I reflected back to when John Kennedy was shot. It's a tragic experience.
It's unbelievable. I don't think people can take it in, and will for a long time.
When my father died of cancer, she was there. She was there in the hospital, and she came to my father and shook my father's hand, and that made my father's day for the last part of his life. And I feel so sad today. I just want to cry.
As you listened to stories like those and looked at the images of all those bouquets stacked up in front of Buckingham Palace, what was going on there?
Well, I was on the cusp of this idea in any case, but when I saw those bouquets, that's when it hit me, because they looked like cannons, but of course they weren't. And the phrase virtual revolution popped into my head, and that became one of the guiding ideas of the work that went into this book. Virtual revolution stands for the movement on the part of erstwhile spectators to take over or share the stage with celebrities. The most obvious example, of course, is the great reality show explosion. But blogging, iPodding, and since you decided to be emblematically self-conscious, Neil, I'm going to say call-in radio shows as well.
Sure, yeah.
These are all areas where this virtual revolution is taking place. And the spectacle of that week in London, which was essentially one gigantic long event performance, fused. You couldn't separate the performative elements from the real ones, and even the motive, the fundamental motive of the mourners, if you remember, was to get the Queen to come out and share her feelings, which is such a prototypical need for virtual revolutionaries in this mediated space.
Because we're expressing our feelings and we think everybody should.
Yes.
it's that reaching for feeling. One of the analogies you draw throughout this book is the idea that we are all, in a way, method actors.
Yeah.
And that method acting and therapy have a lot in common.
Oh, huge amount in common. I mean, the core idea in this book is a memory I actually have of being in acting school when Kennedy's death was announced, and somehow the impression got circulated around the real room full of actors that this was a premise for an improvisation. And so we all proceeded to improvise the premise that the president had been shot and killed and so on. And then when we found out, and we were good actors, we were method actors. That the whole point of the method is to be real and not to act in quotes, not to strike poses, but to live through things. And so there was this moment when it was all over and we realized that, in fact, this was a real event, the better you were as an actor, the fewer your spaces were to go to react truthfully to this. And the techniques that people use in method to train method actors are so close to the kinds of techniques that therapy, group therapy, role playing, and so on that therapists use.
The idea
getting in touch with your feelings is the goal in both cases.
And in the case of the method actor, you get in touch with your real feelings and then perform them.
That's right.
And that's what you say so many of us do. In fact, all of us do.
I think, but take therapy as a classic example. I mean, don't forget the Justin's helmet principle.
Okay.
This is mostly a good thing. I mean, people who've been in therapy are likely to be better parents to their children than people who haven't been in therapy. I mean, these are profoundly good thing. But you can't deny that it's a mediating thing, that it makes you reflexive and self-conscious about yourself to a degree that's very different from generations past.
And just for those who missed the Justin's helmet principle, this is the idea that though we wax nostalgic for the unsupervised play of our youth, when it comes to our kids, they're going to have a bicycle helmet.
That's right.
Okay. Because it's safer, it's better.
It's better. It looks silly. I mean, if you go to some of these playgrounds in certain neighborhoods, you start thinking, gee, why don't you just raise the kid in a bubble? I mean, aesthetically, there's something sort of diminishing about it, but in fact, it's better than having a kid break his neck. I mean, please.
We're talking today with Thomas DeZengotita. He's the author of the newly published book, Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Mark, who's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The first thing that came to my mind when you mentioned over-mediation of our society is a book that was written about 25, 30, maybe it's almost 40 years ago now, 1978, by Jerry Mander, The Four Arguments for Elimination of Television. And he speaks intently about many things in relation to the images being portrayed today electronically, specifically on television. But more recent books he's talked about, this has now transcended into the computer world, and it's become even more pronounced, I think, with computer images, something that concerns many of us today as educators, too. But the images, seemingly real on TV screens, and, of course, I guess I'm speaking for a lot of people that would understand this and relate to it, that it's getting away from nature. It's detaching us from how we evolved and evolutionarily.
Thomas DeZengotita, the example of this you use in your book is an exhibit on microclimates for various sorts of wildlife. and what's the title?
The name of this little hall in a small zoo in New York is the Hall of Animal Lifestyles, and to me that's an indicator of just how deeply the idea of optionality has sunk into a mediated world and mediated people who exist in it. But the point about getting away from nature is, I mean, I think the caller is right about what the cumulative effect of these images is in any case, to the point where I actually believe that for a person who cares a great deal about nature and makes a point of going into natural settings and to experience them and to try to get back close to nature, camping, and the more rigorous and severe, the better. I think if you kind of watch yourself while you do that, if you're one of those kinds of people, you'll notice this kind of strange, haunting effect of mediation in your experience with nature. And that is that when you're there in the wilderness represents itself somehow, as well as being itself to you. That's how mediated your mind is. You frame something that's real in such a way that it can represent itself.
Mark, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate it. Let's talk now with Gabriel. Gabriel's calling from Denver.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Gabe.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, I'm a historian, and I'm intrigued by your guest's comment. There's a philosopher by the name of French philosopher by the name of Régis Debray who's argued a similar thing, talking about how consciousness is changed by changes in media. But as a historian, I find evidence to the contrary. It seems to me that the people I study in the 19th century who worked with letters are very self-aware of themselves as actors, the letters that they wrote were not meant only privately, but also as public documents. They were read out loud and reread. And I could imagine other historians who are familiar with even earlier periods in Leon could talk about the self-awareness of their actors.
Yeah.
So I wonder, what is it, what technological changes in media seem to have caused this dramatic change in consciousness that I am quite skeptical of?
That's an excellent question, and the real answer is a long one, and you have to go to the book for it. But basically, the increase in self-consciousness in moderns has been going on since print and literacy. That media, too, had the beginnings of this mediating effect. But my guess is that if you look at the way in which people performed when they read their letters and so on in the period that the caller's talking about, the model for performance in those days was likely to be theatrical. That is to say, it would involve large gestures. It would involve striking certain kinds of conventional poses. How could I put this? It's a self-consciousness that's overt, and that's what writing and literacy and kind of self-consciousness that writing and literacy encourage. The kind of self-consciousness that we're talking about now, under the regime of the media we've got now, it goes back to the method acting. It's a kind of naturalism. It's an environment in which people no longer get dressed up to go to the theater, don't get dressed up to go traveling, don't get dressed up to go on an airplane. There's a broad and general informality and naturalism about people in our culture, and the way in which they perform their lives is also naturalistic in that way, and that's the difference between the regime of mediation in the current context and what it was like in print and literacy context.
Gabriel, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And we're going to have more with Thomas D. Zengotita when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to join us, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Are there ways in which you perform your past personality in daily life? You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're looking straight into the yawning jaws of postmodernism with a conversation about mediation and how our increasing self-consciousness is changing the world we live in. Of course, you're invited to join us. Is it getting hard to tell what's real and what's not? Has the definition of real changed? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Thomas D. Zengotita, author of Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. Here's an email we got from David. Has your guest considered the explosion of online dating over the past 5 years and as an example of performative living? If not, I think he should. The profiles are extremely elaborate, frequently including video and sound bites, in addition to long essays about the goals and personality of the poster.
Absolutely. And I touch on that in the book in connection with the fact that a lot of what I've learned about mediation I've learned from my students. And they've described the sort of beach, you know, endless beach out there in the ether that they log onto and meet people on. I couldn't possibly negotiate that world, but I'm aware of it. Just a quick word, Neil, on this business about what's left that's real and what's the opposite of real. I think it's an important point to make here is that the opposite of real sort of goes back to the last caller's point. The opposite of real isn't natural. The opposite of real isn't phony or artificial anymore, I don't think. I think the opposite of real is optional. And you can hear that in the little idiom people use when they say, look, the reality is X. And what they mean by that is this is something, at least, that you have to deal with, that you have no choice over. I think the opposition between real and phony or real and artificial goes back to Romanticism, and it's outdated. So much is representational now. Even, as I said before, even an untouched natural thing in some sort of way represents itself because of the frame of mind you bring to it, that the axis of opposition has shifted away from phony to optional.
There are, though, still some things over which we do not have choices.
That's for sure. That's right.
You described two of them, cancer and children.
Yes, and especially when they're first born, and any parent knows about this, the amazement and the, the bewildering facing of this little being that you didn't choose. You may have made a whole lot of choices during the pregnancy, and you made a whole lot of choices about how to go through the birthing experience and all of that. But when the little child pops out, man, that she or he, they come from beyond, you know. So that's one thing. And so do tragic accidents and illnesses and death. And so also, incidentally, this is a good way to take the temperature of the difference between optionality and reality. The little teeny accidents can have the same effect. You know, if you break down somewhere on a highway and you weren't planning there's no cars around, no people around, let's say you've got no gizmos, you've got no cell phone, you've got nothing to toy with, you've got no media around you, and you have to sit there for a couple of hours on the side of the road just listening to the insects hum and looking at the sky, after a while, you'll realize what it's like to be in an environment that wasn't designed to affect you, that isn't addressing you all the time, that isn't soliciting your attention all the time. And the fact that those experiences are so rare now is a measure of how far we've come in the direction of total representational existence.
Let's get another caller on the line. Carrie is with us from Phoenix.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm raising three young children. I have a sociology background, and I find it amazing the way the media influences my kids at all times. I limit the TV use. I limit the kinds of movies I let them see because I find them that they mimic the roles that they see being played by actors and actresses or by cartoon characters, and I want them to be creative. I want them to be individuals. I don't want them to be a copy of whatever they see around them.
And how old are they?
They are 5, 7, and 9.
Do you address this issue with small children and how they look at the media that they take in?
Are you talking to me? Yes,
I was. Yes,
I do, but not quite in that way. What I'm, she's perfectly correct, of course, about all the imitation that goes on. What's going to happen as those kids get older, though, is that they're going to become very aware of what they're imitating and what they're not imitating and what certain people imitate and what other people. They're going to become very savvy consumers of all that imagery, and they're going to make an evolving set of choices about what kinds of mediated entities they want to surround themselves with. And they're, in effect, going to construct themselves construct a little me world around themselves. Think of a teenager's bedroom, for example, in these days, and the way in which that acts as an almost like a hall of mirrors around the kid, telling the kid who he or she is or becoming. So I think there's the caller may be underestimating the amount of reflexivity and navigability that these children are enjoying as they do this.
Carrie, good luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Unsurprisingly, the television program The Simpsons offers you a lot of material for your theory of self-conscious parenting. Here's a clip from the show.
You're going to ignore Grandpa for the rest of your life?
Of course not, Marge. Just for the rest of his life. He said I was an accident. He didn't want to have me.
You didn't want to have Bart.
I know, but you're never supposed to tell the child.
You tell Bart all the time. You told him this morning.
But when I do it, it's cute.
From your read, what's going on here?
Well, I'd have to see more. I have great respect for that show, by the way, so I don't want the Simpsons fans out there to think otherwise. It is a measure of how ironic it's possible to be about the most important and immediate social context most people live in, and that is the family and bringing up your children. And I have a section in the book called Ironic Parenting, and what I mean by that is parents who are so aware of having made certain kinds of choices about how to be a parent that they're so reflexive habitually that they sort of include the kid in the reflexivity they have about being the parent and make the kid aware very early, in addition to all the other media which are doing it too, like The Simpsons, of that they're not just the little boy that they are, but that they're a kid. And this goes all across the spectrum. You know, you see T-shirts and things like, "Because I'm the mommy, that's why," on the T-shirt. That's a mommy who's going to make a kind of joke about disciplining the kid even as she disciplines him, and make the kid aware that that there's a role being performed here in both the theatrical and the sociological sense. And the examples of this sort of, I remember saying to my children, I can't believe, I'd say something like, look, you have to do your share of the chores in this house or blah, blah, blah. And then I'd stop myself and say, I can't believe I'm saying this, remembering when I was at the receiving end.
Channeling your parents, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And then I'd say that. I wouldn't just think it. And then my children grew up to be a beautiful, wonderful children are they ironic and self-reflexive and aware of themselves. They were kind of making little jokes about ironic jokes about themselves by the time they were 10 years old. Mm-hmm. I remember my daughter telling me once, I knew she was feeling bad about something, and I went up to her room to help, sort of see if she wanted to talk about her feelings, whatever was going on. And she says, Dad, I'm just having a little identity crisis. And it's perfectly normal at my age. I swear, 10 years old. Now, that's a kind of reflexivity which, by the way, Justin's helmet again, is mostly a good thing. But when I think of the way my parents, God love them, raised me, the amount of self-consciousness involved in the whole relationship was next to nothing compared to what it was between me and my children.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is James. James is calling from New Hartford, New York.
That's right.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. One of the questions I was wondering about, I teach a media studies course for a local high school here, and we spent the last week talking about very celebrated performers like Bob Dylan and this whole issue of the persona that surrounds certain celebrities. And I guess what I'm wondering, it's not a question I've been able to answer for myself, and my students have been thinking about this week, is what sort of implications does this sort of performing in the public, so to speak, or creating this persona actually have on our young people, not necessarily like the young folks that you've been talking about, but our teenagers as well, who try to emulate someone who's in fact just creating some sort of mystique or persona.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a whole chapter in the book that centers around a section called Twilight of the Heroes, in which I explain why public figures can't really be heroic anymore, essentially because they're so covered in such detail, it's impossible for them to seem heroic, whereas performers, especially pop music performers like Dylan, can be heroes. And the reason they can be heroes is because they're represented frugally enough and in a controlled enough environment at a concert or in a CD that there's still enough room left for us to provide the kind of mythic depth and weight that a hero has to have, and that ordinary heroes like, Lincoln or Jefferson or Napoleon used to have. It's really the follower who's providing the hero with the mythic resonance. And pop musicians are a perfect example of that. And the difference between them and, say, the days when heroes were generals and statesmen is that, of course, ultimately, performer heroes, Bob Dylan, what he's saying to you, what he's doing to you as a fan, isn't leading you into some cause. He's telling you who you are or who you want to be. Ultimately, you adore a pop musician because they put into words the emerging self that you see yourself as. And so they're... Again, it's all about you. Again, this flattery of mediation is at work in the case of performer heroes. I hope you'll read the book, and I'd love to hear what your students think about that chapter on music.
But to some
extent, really giving me something to talk about. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. But I was just saying, aren't some of those performers, to some degree, they are brand names for a lifestyle as well?
Absolutely, absolutely. Brand names. Garth Brooks. That's a perfect way to put it. And people now, here's another measure. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've noticed. Kids are all about mixes now. That's what iPods are. They don't sort of have albums and sit there dotingly listening to every track the way we did with Beatles albums or something. They take the cuts they like from this place and that place and the other place, and they make mixtapes for themselves. That's what iPod is. That's why it's so successful. Again, they're the creator, the producer, in a way the performer of playing a performative role in the construction of their own musical environment so that it exactly reflects and expresses their tastes and inclinations at the moment. And so they choose among brands. Those brands, I'm going back to your idea about performers as brand names. Mm-hmm. So they choose among brands depending on their moods.
We're talking with Thomas DeZengotita. He's the author of Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's a caller, Peggy. Peggy's with us from Oakland.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm fascinated to hear this conversation because for a while I've wondered about how often I formulate my opinions by picturing myself voicing them to an audience or to friends. And I've always considered myself an independent thinker, so it sort of disturbs me to think that I place so much value on the way that I appear to when I form those opinions.
Hmm. Peggy, that's perfect. And that's the kind of thing that this book's about that makes it different from other books about the media. It's about the internal psychocultural effects of media and this image of you sort of shaping your opinions by imagining yourself having this conversation with others and expressing those opinions. That's a perfect measure of the performative dimension in your relationship to yourself.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Peggy. I used to, when writing a story, I would end up talking to myself all the time, which usually meant that I got a seat on the subway by myself. These years, of course, everybody's on a cell phone, so that doesn't work anymore. So
I think, you know, going back to a caller a few callers ago who was saying, what's the difference between the way people performed, you know, 300 years ago and the way they do now? He could have something to say about this exchange we just had with Peggy. But again, the same difference would apply. I'm sure that my father's father, for example, if he had a big important social occasion or business thing to take care of, and he's thinking about how he'd do it, I'm sure that he pictured himself in his mind making the presentation or having the conversation. And human beings have always been self-conscious in that way. But what he was doing, again, was seeing himself sort of externally and checking out himself in terms of appropriateness and convention and the expectations for how a person ought to act in circumstances like this. The content of Peggy's monitoring of herself ahead of time as she shapes her own opinion is much more internal, much more naturalistic, much more psychological, much more intimate.
Well, here's an example from recent politics. You identify President Clinton's State of the Union speech in 1999 as one of the great moments of mediated politics. He got up to address the Congress during his impeachment. And here's a clip from NPR's Mara Liasson, Morning After Analysis.
Sometimes the president provided color commentary for his own speech, praising Democrats and Republicans when they stood up together for a change.
That was encouraging, you know. There was more balance on the seesaw. I like that.
President Clinton may not have called attention to the impeachment trial,
but that's what he was talking about.
Absolutely.
An amazing moment.
Amazing. And, I mean, listen to the informality of that comment. I mean, imagine Lincoln or Roosevelt or Reagan was informal, but he was a Republican. He was informal in a Republican way. Clinton was, with Clinton, method acting burst forth onto the, you know, national stage. We had a leader who was the ultimate method actor. I don't think people could ever quite figure Clinton out because they didn't have that category to apply. Let's take his legendary empathy, you know, the way he would, when people, everybody who ever met him and spent any one-on-one time with him, as they say, at all, would comment on the way he listened and the way he made you feel important and the way he really cared about you when he listened. That became legendary about him. And sort of normally restrained people think of that as a sort of emblem of phoniness, but I don't think so. I think his empathy is completely sincere. It's just that it's a performance. It's a method, you know, it's his methody existence. He was the perfect president for this age.
I'm biting my lower lip. When we come back from a short break, we'll finish up our discussion about surviving in the postmodern world and then leave the realm of theory for the very real chaos in the streets of Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about how our media-saturated society is changing how we relate to the world and to ourselves. The ideas come from the brain of our guest, Thomas D. Zengotita, author of Mediated. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Carolyn. Carolyn is with us from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I'm interested in the author's perspective of urban and suburban environments versus the rural environments. I just moved from Washington, D.C., obviously a media-saturated environment. My children actually went to a Steiner school, a Waldorf school, where they are not allowed to watch television or use computers until eighth grade, and I still could not keep the influence of media out of their lives. I've now moved to a rural area, Charlottesville, Virginia, where the media has taken a phenomenal back step in our lives. We sometimes don't get any kind of radio transmission when we're driving. We have to have a satellite dish to pick up television. And our children want to be outside. They don't have to worry about risks on a playground because their playgrounds are trees and creeks and things like that. So this concept of coming from this risk-oriented, media-saturated society to a much more rural society, the role of media, I would say, has dropped out of our lives by about 80%. So I'm wondering if the author has looked at the difference between the urbanization and suburbia versus rural America, and if the role of media and our influence by it has decreased in terms of when you're not as densely populated and as fearful as a culture.
Well, my suspicion is that the drop off, that much of a drop off in the role of media in this particular family's life, has a lot to do with the particular choices that the parents of this in this family are making. The satellite dish was the thing I was kind of waiting to hear about, and I've lived in rural areas myself, and I think the option of not being so mediated is more open to you in a rural setting. I think that's certainly the case, but there are lots of families living way out in rural areas, and that satellite there's up there, and they've got gigantic TV screens in their family dens, and they're playing video games and online poker games, and so there's a lot of diversity, and mediated society is all about a lot of diversity and a lot of choices, and some people do make even more radical choices than the caller. Some people take that TV and throw it away. And
offline.
And yes. I mean, people can unplug. And some people do. But
in this environment, you have a lot of readers. This is a very reading. There's a lot of authors, John Gresham. This is an environment where you don't, in the cafes, hear about what's on the front page of the Post.
Yeah.
That's a really different environment where the paper is an optional read in all of the society.
Is this a thank you for the call, Carolyn. Is this a red state, blue state phenomenon?
The truth is that I haven't done the research that I would have to do to back this up into any kind of a sort of conclusive statement. So I think I'm just going to, as I do frequently in the book, I think I'm trying to set an example to the pundits of the world. I don't really know. And so I think I'm just going to say that.
There are implications, though, for politics. And again, getting back to the Justin's Helmet principle, you think interestingly about globalization.
Yes, this gives me an opportunity. It's a word to all the liberals and other progressives in disarray out there since the election, wondering what to do. This book does not tell anybody what to do, doesn't have a solution. But it is a diagnosis that's all-encompassing and really original. And if there's going to be some strategy moving forward for how we're going to deal with globalization and how we're going to have a progressive politics in a world that's got real threats of terror in it, then the strategy we come up with is going to have to be new, and it's going to have to be grounded in a new diagnosis of the situation. I really don't think that we understand what's going on well enough to make tactical and strategic political decisions right now. And I hope this book's a contribution towards the diagnosis that might make that possible. Globalization's a perfect example. The irony with it is, of course, that at least for certain kinds of progressives, and I've always been one of them, the aesthetic revulsion that I feel about so much of what corporate globalizing entities produce, you know, the rap on Disneyfication and the arches and Starbucks and all of that, gets fused in my mind with what the responsibilities I think globalization has for the immiseration of millions and millions of people who live completely outside of this media bubble, or mostly outside of this media bubble. And so I kind of get to blame the giant corporate entities for the misery that that innocent people in other places are suffering, and at the same time blame them for the fact that I can't turn around without seeing some, you know, brand name chain paper cup thrown on the ground somewhere around me for all of the aesthetic diminishments of our lives that they're responsible for. But what would a progressive say if, this is just a thought experiment, there's nothing realistic about this, but what would a progressive say if you said, suppose globalization and mediation could truly be universal, and everyone in the world could be materially well off, and the environment was protected, and so on, and the only price we had to pay was that the entire world would turn into a gigantic mall with all those food courts representing all those cultures and all the stores with all the clothes, and would all be mediated and all be optional, but no one would be starving, and everyone would have health care. And what would we choose?
Let me just end with this. It's a good question, but let me just end with this email on another and, of course, the same subject. A few years ago, when the TV show Mad About You was in its heyday, I dated a man who thought I resembled Helen Hunt and who fancied himself as witty as Paul Reiser. One day, I realized that he was scripting our relationship to mirror the Helen-Paul relationship on the show.
Oh, my God.
To the extent of using stock dialogue, like, not so much, or this is what I'm saying. Huh. It was very strange, but it was also very easy just to go along with it. In fact, it was even flattering and fun. Not once did I say, this is bogus, and I don't know if we could have sustained it. We never had to find out since he took a job in another city a few months later.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Thomas, go ahead. Did you have a thought about it?
No, not really. That's just, I mean, this thing is so subtle, and it leaks into every nook and cranny of our lives in these subtle ways, and I love gathering examples from callers and stuff because it's just so revealing.
Thomas DeZengotita teaches at NYU and the Dalton School in New York. His book is Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. This was really a good conversation for me. Thank you.
And if you would like to read the first chapter of Mediated on the Talk of the Nation page of our website, www.npr.org.